Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform. I'm Justin Asiri, and each week, my goal is to give military veterans the tools they need to be successful in their civilian career. My guest today for episode number 162 is Amanda Casari.
One of the really nice things that my time in the military brought for that, and someone actually recently complimented me on this, and I thought it was the nicest compliment I might have ever received, was that he said he felt like I was very good at helping to look at something that seemed large and daunting and breaking those down into smaller problems and steps and timelines to accomplish those problems. I feel like you get a lot of that being in the military, especially being from the Naval Academy, because there's quite a bit of time in your career or your time at the Naval Academy where you're just given a task. And then you have to figure out, how am I going to get from, you know, A to B? And then how am I going to get everyone else from A to B? And how far do I really be before I can say that we can go to the next step?
Amanda, as you will soon find out, is a gifted speaker. I just really enjoyed all of the descriptions and explanations she brought to a career that I know very little about and I haven't had on the show much before. She is both a product manager, which we've talked about before, but also a data scientist, which we have not talked about before. And so this is a great episode for those of you considering a career in tech, a functional role of product manager or data scientist. But I think one thing that will come through with Amanda, not just her passion for what she does, but things like work-life balance, remote working, company culture, and another aspect of having a side interest. And she is a published author, soon to be. She's a volunteer with NASA, so active on top of having kids as well. As always, at beyondtheuniform.io, you'll find the show notes. You'll find links to everything we discuss. I would greatly appreciate there if you're able to leave a review on iTunes for the show. It helps get the word out about this this effort. So with that, let's dive into my conversation with Amanda. Joining me today in Seattle, Washington, is Amanda Casari. Amanda, welcome to Beyond the Uniform.
Hi, thanks for having me today.
So I wanted to give our listeners a abbreviated background for Amanda. She is a senior product manager and data scientist with Concur Labs at Concur, a company that provides on... Oh, let me just pause here. We'll have to edit this out. let me just make sure I have that right.
Okay.
Is that the edited version I have there? Is it Concur Labs or is it SAP Concur?
It's Concur Labs at SAP Concur.
Okay.
So it is we are an SAP company. Yeah, that just changed in January 1st.
Congrats. That's got to be exciting.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, it's been 2 years, but it's just the rebranding. But yeah.
Okay. And then whenever I say Concur, should I say SAP Concur?
If you're talking about Concur itself, yes. If you're talking about Concur Labs, it's just Concur Labs.
Okay, great. Let me try that again.
Cool.
For our listeners, I wanted to give a quick background on Amanda. She is a senior product manager and data scientist with Concur Labs at SAP Concur, a company that provides on-demand employee spend management solutions that enable organizations to control their costs. Their customers include over 70% of Fortune 100 and 500 companies. She started out at the Naval Academy, after which she served for 5 years and 1 week as a surface warfare officer. She holds an Master's of Science from the University of Vermont in Electrical Engineering, is a future O'Reilly author, and also volunteers with NASA as a member of the Data Knots. And I'm just, Amanda, I'm just kind of cringing. I was undergrad at the Naval Academy. I was an electrical engineering major, and the thought of doing a master's in electrical engineering, you are one very, very brave person. I imagine that was a grueling experience.
It was actually, I think going to UVM was very beneficial for me in that it's a very interdisciplinary engineering program. So I was a little bit nervous also about doing double E, having been a control systems undergrad, which I did notice, to be honest, after going back to school from 7-year gap between undergrad and master's, the first quarter was challenging because I had this feeling like I constantly should know something.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't a while for me until I realized I was really there to learn. But I was able to kind of look at the tracks and focus on what I was interested in studying. So I ended up with a master's in electrical engineering. I actually took more applied mathematics classes and perhaps equal number of computer science classes that I did to double E classes.
Wow.
So I was able to focus my studies on, I did focus on power systems, which was interesting, but it was on computational modeling of power systems and then looking at how they work as possibly as complex systems or complex networks.
That's great.
So that, I think that was really interesting to me because I didn't really quite go into maybe the areas of EE where I was not as interested in. I got to focus on the things that I did find fascinating.
That's great. Well, maybe to start things off, if you were talking to someone who's serving on active duty and they asked you what you do as a senior product manager and data scientist, how would you explain what you do for a living?
Well, I do a lot of herding cats. So I, on the Concur Labs team, my team acts a little bit as a startup within SAP Concur. So we are really focusing on how do we look at things that are not within the roadmap. So there's about 2,000 people that we have in the R&D and product team at Concur who are looking at what customers ask for, what we need to do for global expansion, how do we support the millions of customers and end users we already have. And our team is trying to look at if we gauge technology horizons, maybe at like 6 months, 1 year, 5 years down the road, which anyone who remembers that, you know, the iPhone only came out 10 years ago, if you're trying to guess what's going to happen in 5 years, that's got to be a pretty good long shot right now with how technology moves. So our team is tasked with really two parts. One is how is Concur going to evolve and change in the next, you know, three horizons? How can we start looking at prototypes, examples, or demos to show our customers what we think that would look like now? And then also, how do we help other teams within Concur who want to be able to get customer feedback outside of the roadmap? How can we get them that customer feedback through a customer beta or be able to build on the Concur platform so that our partners and other people understand what we should be doing and what we can be focusing on to help kind of support the Concur ecosystem? Mm. So with that in mind, my role as a product manager, it kind of expands a little bit beyond that, right? So I look at within our team, I start looking at interesting interactions or partnerships, how consumers are changing how they interact with technology. So for the past 2 years, we've been experimenting with conversational interfaces, which is more commonly known as bots. Some people may think of those as, intelligent assistants, which is something like Siri or Google Home or through Alexa. We can also make little bots inside things like Slack. And so when our team has been experimenting with this, the reason we do it is because we're looking at how is the face of computing changing? How are our consumers used to interacting with technology and where should we be at to meet them with where that technology is? So I do strategy research, prototyping, product management, classical piece is also helping to figure out roadmaps. That's where kind of herding the cats comes in, is because we have to be able to keep an eye on what is everybody doing, all the individual projects, what's our next goal? Where do we want things to be? How do I project manage that? And then how do I do product management on top of that so I understand, you know, what the business case should be for moving forward or moving on to another stage? How do I work with partners within our company, either SAP, SAP Concur, or our partner companies? So I do a little bit of kind of business development, some marketing communications. I think product managers are known for doing a little bit of everything. And the data scientist piece is I spend quite a bit of time also looking at data science, machine learning, AI. I do some individual projects, not as much lately because we are doing quite a bit of work to get towards some customer-facing products. But I also look at ML applications within Concur. I consult with other people within the company to work on their ML projects or data science projects. Sometimes I just answer questions about Python usage. Python's a programming language that is very popular with data scientists and people working with data. So people within the Concur, we have a community of practice where people talk to each other and try to help each other out. And then so I talk with people about that. And I generally try to help understand what is the future of Concur going to look like for machine learning and AI. So we're working with other groups within our company to help us understand how can we advance the company as a whole to be able to make intelligent products for our customers in a transparent and accessible way.
That's really great. I mean, and correct me if I'm wrong, I've always viewed the product manager role at, and I know that probably varies from company to company, but it does seem like it's a little bit of jack of all trades and that you're having to work with account managers or customer support to figure out what customers want. You're having to work with the people that build the product, whether that's engineers or whatever that is. You have to work with the salespeople who are selling it to make sure that they understand. It just kind of gets you involved with every facet of a business as you think through the products you're going to build or modify. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. And I think it's especially coming from a role in the Navy that was very leadership focused. It's really interesting because I think I have never tended to really drive in a singular direction with my career. So I wouldn't call myself necessarily an expert in that I haven't spent 20 years on the same thing. I'm by no means a brain surgeon or a rocket scientist. But I have looked very broadly across what I'm working on and the groups and people that I work with. And I think that range of skills and that approach of collaboration and bringing people towards a singular goal, having been in the military, is extremely beneficial for that kind of role.
And the data scientist, is that a flavor of the product manager? Is that an addition to the product manager, or is it just more common that product managers at Concur Labs are have that skill set of data science?
So I think that on our team, we tend to say that everybody is an and. So you can't just do one thing. We have a product manager who is also a developer evangelist. We have myself, who's a product manager and a data scientist. We have developers who are developers and managers, or developers and game developers. So I think the idea is that we tend to have on our team. It's a very small team. It's only about 10 people. We have about an 8,000 person company. So it's pretty interesting the amount of things we can get done. But so as part of that, I was a data scientist at Concur previously, and it's something I wanted to make sure I got to keep doing in my role. So they asked me what I would like. Basically, they said, here's your core duties. What would you like to do? And I was very fortunate that I got to help define that role when I started off 2 years ago. And so I kept that as part of it, knowing that it's something I love doing, it's I'm passionate about, and I wanted to keep doing. So it is a technical, I think it's kind of a half, I was sorry, Justin, it's about a half product management, half technical role.
And the, when you are more focused on the data science aspect, because I've never had anyone on the show with that background, is that, are you like living and breathing in Excel for that capacity, or are you using some other tool? Like, what is the data science portion look like?
Oh, it's a good question. I actually am a big proponent that you can do data science in almost any data tool. I personally, at work, tend to use Python quite a bit, even for creating APIs. So, data science for, I guess, data science for people who don't know, who is moving from data into a feature or a product or report, and then in between there, between something that is useful and something that is raw data, usually there's other aspects in what's called the data pipeline or the machine learning pipeline, if you're using machine learning. And it's where you're trying to go from something that is raw data into something that is valuable for a consumer. And those are sometimes called insights. So moving from that raw data into something that people can use, you can use Excel for that. There's no reason that you don't have to. Our BI team does quite a bit of that. They use SQL and Excel. Our data science team primarily uses Python and other open source libraries and programming languages. And we use a whole other host. I can go through buzzword bingo if you want to on other things that we use, like Docker and AWS and TensorFlow. I tend to use Python because it's what I'm most interested in. And actually, that's what the recent book that I got to work on with Alice Zhang from Amazon is on feature engineering for machine learning. And that's one piece of that data science pipeline. And it's all written using Python and open source Python libraries. The distinction for that, for once again, if you don't know, open source means that there's different licenses for it, but generally people create nice things and tools, and they open them up for other people to use, and then you get to use them and then accredit them accordingly. I typically live in programming languages, and then I'll make APIs. I'll sometimes work with the other technologists on our team, and we might incorporate those APIs into different applications that we're using. Sometimes it gets created as a dashboard. So I've used also the programming language R before, which is just the singular letter R. And then I've created what's called a Shiny app, which is a nice way of doing a visualization. I've used D3, which is another form. It's a JavaScript language for showing visualizations for data in the background. There's a whole host of things you can use. I think as a data scientist, you have to be somewhat nimble, being able to choose between the different platforms and what the team's working on. And then you get to be a little bit choosy about what's running underneath, depending on who's supporting it.
I love that, though. I mean, it seems like such a compelling role and in some ways daunting to me, but to think of taking all of these different sources of data and really distilling it into those key insights that are actionable for whoever the stakeholder is, whether that's the customer, or whether that's your manager or part of the team, but just kind of really working to refine down to like these key takeaways that they can then use in whatever they're doing.
Yeah. And I think once again, and I know it's the focus of the podcast, but one of the really nice things that my time in the military brought for that, and someone actually recently complimented me on this, and I thought it was the nicest compliment I might've ever received, is that he said he felt like I was very good at helping to look at something that seemed large and daunting and breaking those down into smaller problems and steps and timelines to accomplish those problems. I feel like you get a lot of that being in the military, especially being from the Naval Academy, because there's quite a bit of time in your career or your time at the Naval Academy where you're just given a task. And then you have to figure out, how am I going to get from, you know, A to B? And then how am I going to get everyone else from A to B? And how far do I really be before I can say that we can go to the next step, right? So I think there was always the idea of, you have a solution, like what is the best solution and what's the solution you can do right now? And being able to articulate that in a problem, like a data science problem, is very useful because you really want people to understand that you're not looking at something that's impossible. It's technology and math, and the problem might need to be restated, and there might need to be some iterative methods on that, but that's kind of all part of the whole idea of doing data science.
And I want to drill even further into your work, but maybe just to set the foundation for all of this, could you give context about Concur Labs and what they do as an organization?
Sure, yeah. So a good example would be 2 years ago when I first joined the team, So I think I said previously, our job is to build on the Concur platform, show what's possible, and look at new horizons for customers, as well as provide avenues for people within Concur to look outside the roadmap to get feedback. And 2 years ago, when I joined the team, it was announced shortly afterwards that we were going to be launching an integration between SAP Concur and Microsoft Outlook. And so our team was actually the team that that owns that product. It's an add-in in the Microsoft O365 store. I think it's called Concur on Outlook or Concur Expense on Outlook. And what it is it's a way that Microsoft Outlook when you have O365, which is their software as a service backend. So not something that's deployed within your company or sitting underneath your desk, but something that's up in the cloud. They have an add-in store, which is different companies build ways that you can do things kind of within app, kind of like a Google Chrome extension. So the Outlook add-in from Concur Labs allows you to take a receipt that's an email, and then we run that receipt through our data science APIs, which is similar to the ones that we use for ExpenseIt. We'll take a receipt, and then we'll break it down into line items. So if you file an expense or an expense report, there's common things that everybody wants to see from their employees. They want to know the date that you're expensing it on. They want to know who they're paying that money to, which is the vendor. They might want to know the amount the date is for, how you paid for it, or you expect to be reimbursed, the location of that. So we take those simple fields, and we pre-populate them through those data science APIs, and then consumers can change things within that, and then submit their expense receipt. So we've actually calculated that by doing this, we're saving people, I think it's up to like, we can possibly be saving somebody up to a few minutes per receipt by having it within their inbox, as opposed to having to go to the website, upload things on the receipt store and then converting it to an expense line item, especially for users who are not very familiar. So some people file expense reports regularly, and they have these web flows that are really quick, and it's easy for them to find exactly what they need. Some people, if they want, don't do it very often, then when they do work towards filing an expense report, it can be something that maybe you put off for a while or you don't want to do so quickly. And so we're trying to, what Concur Labs was looking at was, through this announcement, what is something that we can put together and how can we put together a story where we're bringing Concur to where you work? So the Microsoft Outlook was one way of bringing Concur to where you look. It's built on top of the Concur platform because we use the Concur APIs underneath. And then we're looking at how do we help kind of adjust the idea of just going to a website or a mobile app and maybe just bringing the functionality that you want into the apps that you're using. I would say other things that we do at Concur Labs, besides things like a large partnership announcement, another one that we had was at reInvent last year. They announced that Alexa for Business and Concur were going to be working together. So we, our team, once again, we developed a skill on the Alexa platform, specifically the Alexa for Business platform, where users can link their Alexa for Business and their Concur accounts, and they can ask for details about their upcoming itinerary.
Oh, wow.
Once again, the use case for this, was we're trying to get you the information you need in the place you need it and the actions that you need it, so that you're not only thinking of it as, you know, a website that you go to, but really something that's helping you get your work done more efficiently.
It's just, as a growing up watching Star Trek all the time, it's like what you're describing is like, it's that interactive level of computer of being able to get that information that's really valid and just so valuable to be able to do that. Like, I could just see how that would be great to not have to be looking at something to get that information and be able to be doing something else while you're getting ready for a meeting and get that important information about your itinerary or whatever is coming next.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's interesting. It's actually travel itinerary views are two of the golden use cases that every voice assistant. So if you go back and you look at the Google Home announcement, if you look at the Alexa announcement, and I think some of the original other conversational interface announcements, they had exactly what you're describing, where a business traveler is packing for a trip and they ask for information about their upcoming trip. So trying to place information contextually in the right places. And I think the big important part for us at Concur Labs too is there was a big lesson that came, you know, in the late 2000s. And I'm sure you might be thinking about this too, Justin, where you don't want to just take websites or mobile apps and like cram everything into a new interface. Mm-hmm. So it, whatever exists in the mobile app, I think initially when we were designing for them, people took a whole website and shrunk it down to a small screen and very quickly learned that that's not how people interacted with that technology. Voice assistants, I think right now, are still being explored and understood by consumers. And so the technology companies behind them, like us, are trying to understand what's the appropriate use cases depending on the platform? And then also, how do we design so that consumers feel like information is useful? I think, and like you said, it's not ever present in a way that is distracting or that feels invasive, but in a way that you are opting in, your privacy is being respected, and you're getting information that you would want when you would want it and not in a way of maybe spamming you. So I think that's really the goal that we have been looking at with these interactions. And those lessons we're feeding back into the company. So we've been looking at this, I said, for about 2 years now. We're ready to kind of move beyond those initial interactions and start looking at more advanced use cases, which I'm very excited about. And I think that hopefully we can help start feeding that back into not only Concur, but SAP to gain an understanding of where really is this line between what consumer data want and where they want it and where that kind of work-life line is between consumer and business products.
That's great. And I appreciate the detail and specificity you bring. I think you're taking even something that's for me is kind of an abstract role and you're making it very concrete. And I wanted to ask you about how this translates into day-to-day life. And I know that a lot of listeners have reached out to me and said that they really appreciate
if you're able to include kind of some timestamps, I know they like to get a sense of like, okay, what time is she getting into the office? How late is she working? What are her weekends like? But could you take us through maybe an example? I imagine your day varies day to day, but maybe just an example of what your day looks like and the sorts of activities you're doing throughout the day, and also a sense of who you're interacting with, whether you're in isolation working on these things or with teams, and how that changes throughout the day.
Sure. Yeah. I think, so typical weekday, I'm actually the one who has, so I have two kids at home and I have morning duty. So I am the one who, I sometimes wake up a little bit early. I think that's on my 2018 goals list, is to wake up earlier than I do so that I can do something besides just get myself ready before the kids wake up. So I tend to be in the office around 9:30 by the time everyone kind of gets ready, gets out the door. So around 9:30 is when I get in. I usually spend that first few time checking in on communications. I do check in on my phone initially in the morning just to see if there's any emergencies. So I have both email and Slack on my phone. And so I'll check across the different channels. And then I do check Twitter in the morning as well, which I wish I did not. I actually have cut back a lot on social media. I've taken almost all of it off of my phone. The way that I do check now is I check on mobile on Twitter. So my earlier comment about the mobile websites probably is interesting for that. but Slack is my team. I'm on a few different Slack channels at my company, as well as across different communities that I participate in. I don't tend to check the communities as much in the morning, but I do check my team. Mostly to see, because that's where my team posts if someone's working from home or if somebody's sick or if we have a meeting change. And then I don't reply to any emails. I just kind of glance and see if any of my calendar has changed. So when I get to work at 9:30, I tend to try to follow up on any emails or communication that needs to happen as early as possible. So that way that's out of the way. Our team has stand up at 10:45. So stand up is, instead of having hour long or week long update meetings, our team gets together for 15 minutes and we sometimes stand up. We should do that more often. But we also set up a Zoom for our remote team members. That's one thing I really like about my team. We've done a lot of work in the last year to be good about always setting up things for people who are not possibly in the office. We can talk more about that later. But we set up Zoom. We have people call in. We all go in our team room. And then we talk about what we did yesterday, what we're doing today, if we're blocked on anything, and if we have anything additional that needs more conversation, we put it in what's called the parking lot. Generally, this devolves a little bit at the end of the meeting. That's what my team called squirreling, and that's just kind of what we do. But then around 11 o'clock, we're pretty much done with the conversations. I have my days do vary. Sometimes I put on my headphones and I shut off Slack and I try to just do nothing but go heads down and work, especially when things pile up. Sometimes I have meetings all day long where I actually work to schedule my meetings. It's either 25 minutes long or it's 50 minutes, 45 or 50 minutes long, to try to give people transition time between. I found that I appreciate when other people do this, so I try to do that as well by default on my meeting invite. I've usually found that those extra 5 to 10 minutes have not impacted getting things done during the meeting. So we do meetings. Sometimes I drive to Seattle to talk with partners. Sometimes I'm on a business trip. I have some conferences I get to speak at or attend. And then when I'm doing that, I try to fit in meetings with other partners or people that I know from the community in the cities, and then also maybe working at a remote office. And then in the office as well, my team's pretty chatty. So we have an open work area. We do have a team room where sometimes people go in and we'll just sit and then talk with each other at work. I'm the one who usually sets up working sessions and the check-in sessions as the product manager. So if we have something we need to work through, like if we're working on getting a product into an app directory and we have to go through the list and set up our work items, I do that. All of these kind of happen. So lunchtime usually is in there. My team likes to go out to lunch. Sometimes I bring lunch. I'll try to sometimes fit a workout in. So there's actually a gym 1.5 miles from here. And there's another very lovely woman at the company who we've started climbing every Wednesday, which is very exciting. And so that's usually about the day. I tend to leave, because I get in at 9:30, I tend to leave somewhere around usually about 5:30 or so. to get home. I sometimes do work in the evenings. I don't do work every night. I have a lot of kind of side projects, like the books that I am still working to kind of get through the process of getting it out the door. I sometimes do volunteering, like with the Data Knots, and then there's other things where maybe I'll read. But yeah, I think that's mostly weekends. Unless there's a large event coming up, or if I have a conference talk, or I've taken on a project, I actually try not to get on my computer, if it's at all possible. I may still interact with my team on Slack, because it's just kind of our method of communication. We share books and articles, and then every now and then kind of bring up if somebody has an idea. And then I also, if I have ideas when I'm not at work, I tend to track that in Trello on my phone. So I would say those are kind of the ways that I manage mind space, and then also work-life balance is trying to, when I'm at the office, really be at the office. If I have to, I may take calls. If I have to do calls earlier, then I'll trade off time kind of with my husband about who's working when. And then I might take calls earlier from my house, and then which sometimes things start as early as 6 because we work on different coasts or with companies from Europe. And if not, or I have calls later in the evening, I may try to take those from home. I would say the culture at SAP Concur is very human-centered. So they work very hard to make sure that employees are valued as people, and that we balance our expectations and what we need to do as a part of work with the fact that people have lives outside of the office, which honestly is one of the most wonderful things about working here.
Hmm. I, first of all, just so much appreciate that description. I got to take you on the road with me. I thought that was such a great way to get a glimpse into what your life is like, and you did just a beautiful job of making it very vivid. And two things that stand out to me is it seems like you found a company that really works to support not just that work-life balance aspect, but also the ability. I love what you had said. I'd love to dive into that further about the remote working, because it's very cool to see that they're incorporating, allowing people to work from different locations and still have them be part of the team. And it seems like that's the direction that most that technology and companies are headed. I'm not sure if they're there yet, but it's like allowing through Slack and Zoom and Google Hangouts, allowing teams to collaborate remotely, and also just giving people more autonomy to be able to have a little bit more flexibility in terms of when they work and how they work. And you had kind of bookmarked that. I'd love to just kind of take you up on that to dive in a little bit deeper about the different ways in which you're allowed to work remotely and how that is structured.
Sure. I think my first clue into how this would be supported at Concur is the day that I checked in, they handed me my computer, and then waiting on my computer in my email was a lot of emails from IT that had already set up everything I would need to do work not in the office. So I had a VPN, instructions for how to set up my VPN, instructions for beyond my email, how to set up web conferencing, instructions for how to communicate via messaging on the company with everybody else. I feel like starting that off was really a good signal to me as an employee that my time was valuable, but my time was not expected to be encompassed in a seat at a desk, and that's the only place I would be measured as having value. I think that's especially important for people who have responsibilities outside of a company. That signaling to them is letting them know that you have responsibilities, you're here for a reason, we have expectations of you, but we also have expectations that life is going to happen, and that it's best for us to be able to plan that from the beginning, as opposed to waiting until, you know, maybe you don't feel so well. You're not coming to the office because you don't want to spread, you know, the flu or germs or whatever it is that might be bubbling up. But you feel well enough to take that call that happens at 9 o'clock. So we'll just give you the way to do that, and you don't have to ask for it, right? You don't have to reach out to IT. You don't have to reach out to your manager. We're going to let you know that you can be a part of the business, and you can also respect other people and your coworkers and yourself. I think that goes a little bit farther beyond the company into company culture and team culture. This is a little bit selfishly my project 2 years ago, Justin, because I knew I was going to be going on maternity leave about 6 months after I joined my team. And so knowing that, when I saw how close my team was, but I also saw how close they were when you're right next to each other, I made it a personal project that I wanted to increase the way that our team thought and worked with each other when you weren't right next to each other in the office. So we increased Slack usage to be able to share conversations. And I most of our team is here. Some people either work remotely. We do have one person who's permanently in San Francisco. And so I'm going to admit, we don't do a perfect job. There's still conversations that happen, you know, across the table that I wish we could figure out, like, how do we translate that into a way that has been captured and shareable a little bit more than it is now. But at the time, I remember I was reading a lot of articles and blogs by 18F. So 18F is an organization within the General Services Administration, so the GSA. It's actually a government organization, and there were some absolutely brilliant people. There are brilliant people who are still working there, but I remember the team that was working there about 2 years ago when I was doing this research that had great blogs on how do you work better as a distributed team? How do you set up communications? How do you set up that time that you can actually just run into people? So I remember they were writing about setting up teas or coffees. And so we have a standing 30-minute session with our distributed team member on Thursdays to just have coffee and chat about nothing in particular. And that leads to a lot more interesting conversations. And I'm hoping a closer team relationship. It's still a work in progress. The other thing that I think our team does that I really like is every single meeting that I set up, I always set up a web call with. So there's always going to be a conference call. There's always going to be a video add-in. And I think across the company, we've gotten better about that. So you never have to ask somebody to set up a conference call. It's just assume that it should be as part of the meeting invite. There are quite a bit of people too. Concur's pretty spread out. I think we have at least 12 development centers. So you could be working on a product and that person could be up on the 12th floor or they could be in Bangalore. And so it's going to be that you have to figure out how do we help make sure that everybody is included on the project in a way that we're all up to speed and that we're using, you know, a lot of them are cloud tools to be able to get so that everybody's in sync.
That's great. It feels like I'm hearing about the way that workplaces will be in, a couple years or maybe sooner. And I love that early indication when you were just first even starting there, how you knew right away that was going to be part of the culture that you were joining.
Yeah, I think I would love to see, you know, obviously this is challenging. I would love to see us kind of as a mindset kind of changing and thinking about how do we communicate differently with each other and even within the same company, like how do we look at our communication channels and really figure out the best way to go about, directing communications in the right channels, because it can get overwhelming. I think sometimes if you work for a larger company, just like when you're in the military, you can open up your inbox at the end of the day and it's, you know, double or triple digits and you're not really sure where all those came from or what all those mean. There's a lot of really interesting work being done right now looking at what is essentially knowledge search across companies. There's some great startups who are trying to tackle how do we help you search across the multiple tools that you have. I was talking with a data scientist from Atlassian. She told me she was working on some interesting projects. So Atlassian is a company that creates products like Confluence and Jira. And these are products that are used to track information, create Wikipedia or internal wikis, as well as track workflows across products and teams. And they're trying to figure out, like, how do we better surface the right information from the right place when you're looking for it, almost, you know, from a single search line. I think all of those are kind of a fascinating way of really looking at, like, how should we be thinking about, you know, the next place that we're working at and where we're going to be, like, where companies and teams are going to be working better together and not just really just showing up and waiting for somebody to hand you something.
And if someone is listening to this and they're on active duty and they think that they might like this as a career path, do you have any thoughts on indications that they may love a career in product management and data scientist and indications that they may hate it?
Oh, that's a good question. I think one of the things is if you don't like taking notes at meetings, not that nobody else can do it, a lot of what product management is information collection, filtering, and kind of putting it in the right places, almost kind of like being a librarian. There's a little bit of the project tracking. Like if you didn't like the project or program tracking, if you're in the military and you don't like that now, that kind of organizational awareness, bringing people together all to the same place, that's quite a bit of the product management. If you want to be an expert and you want to really just focus on one area, I think you can do that if you're focusing on one type of product. But like you said earlier, you really have to look at cross-business collaborations. So you don't get to, I'm sure you could probably just, you know, keep your head down and not really talk to anybody. I find it's much more effective to try to get in-person communication, even if it's just something, you know, a quick call over Slack. I've done quite a bit of that with people who are not right next to me. For data science, if you don't like math and you want nothing to do with math, I'd recommend you look somewhere else. I would say as part of that, as a caveat, if you like math, but you think you're bad at it, I would advise you that nobody's bad at math. At least I don't think anybody's bad at math. I think it's a learned skill, and that sometimes you just have to approach things a few times before it becomes interesting. I think it's a paraphrase quote from von Neumann that mathematics isn't something that makes sense. It's something you get used to. So I like to tell people data science is somewhat similar. You kind of just, it's something that you work on. It's not something you know right away. So don't be intimidated by it. Maybe, you know, if you're interested in it. Right now, most people who are data scientists who have the most success getting work usually right now have masters and PhDs because that's what the field has been thus far, especially for advancing machine learning. There are programs right now at undergraduate universities, and there's boot camps and certificates, I think, for data science. There's groups who are working on very cool transition programs. If you do have a master's or a PhD, there's very interesting groups who can help you look at transitioning from that sort of life into data science if you're interested. I would say those are always good to check out too. And if you can see the kind of projects that they're working on, if you think those are fascinating, then that's a good indicator you would want to do it.
That's great. And the other question you've already partially answered, I was going to ask about kind of common paths that people take to this sort of role. It sounds like, you know, master's, PhD is certainly one of those routes. Any other thoughts on kind of the common entry points into this sort of role?
Yeah, I think product managers, to be honest, in technology tend to be valued most when they have a little bit of technical background. So you can look at people who are doing product management roles. A lot of the hiring managers will, because the engineering teams and the technical teams are asking for somebody who has a little bit of experience, and mostly for that is they want to make sure that when they're explaining things to you, that they can explain it in a way that you understand and they don't feel like you're slowing them down. So I do think there's an interesting, I don't want to say barrier, but there's an interesting intersection there where, you know, the company is looking for people who can track products and show value and be able to elevate ideas. The team is looking for people who can bring that technical edge. If you're very good at doing all of the management pieces, you may not want to have that background in technical. And if you like being technical, you may not want to jump up and do things with management. So I think sometimes you can show that intersection and interest through either personal projects or through other ways that you're working on, you know, an engineering background or technical background. But I would say that that's something that is, it's not always outspoken out loud. Like you won't see on the description, we're looking for a technical product manager. But if you ask the team or the hiring manager, they will say, well, we prefer someone with a technical background because of X, Y, and Z. For data scientists, I would say that even though it's been around for a few years now, it's still something that companies are trying to understand what's the right background that we need for the roles that we're saying. So data scientists right now at some companies can mean about 10 different things. It can also be 10 jobs in one that they're calling under one job description. And that's when you know you might not want to be there, to be honest, because you're way too high of expectations. But a good place to start for that is to have some kind of STEM analytical undergraduate experience. And then if you want to have, depending on the company, if you want to be able to move forward on that, you can add on through some online learning, through selling shim projects, through certificates or boot camps. If you already have an MS or a PhD, which I know not everybody in the military does, but say that you do. There's some great programs like Insight Data Science Fellows, which is actually based out of San Francisco, but has remote programs. And they look at how can we help people with advanced degrees become data scientists and data engineers. So I think that groups like that, you know, you want to screen and kind of dive a little bit deeper into how they're moving it in the next step. IBM is another great company. SAP, of course, is another great company who likes to hire veterans and help progress them and move them on.
And I guess one, I know we're running out of time, but one other question I had is one of the things I really admire about the life that you've built is that you've got this incredibly vibrant career, but you've also done a great job of having active and really fulfilling, it seems like, side projects. And the two examples we've talked about so far is the book that's due out soon, but also your volunteer work with NASA and the Datanauts. What would you want listeners to know both about the work that you're doing, but also how you've been able to carve out time to have these side projects?
Sure. I'd say for the existing projects, you know, obviously the book is fantastic. Everybody should buy it. It's about feature engineering. It's going to be, I think, the first one of its kind out. And the reason for that is that my co-author and I were really looking at how do we help people understand how you move from raw data into those machine learning models.
Yep.
It'll be from O'Reilly. We're excited about that. The Datanauts, I am a complete NASA space fan, and I found that a few years ago they were starting this new project on getting more people interested and involved with the NASA community. And I fill out a lot of applications, Justin. Mm-hmm. So I find out from social media or LinkedIn or, you know, channels of things that I find interesting. And I think I'd rather have someone tell me that, no, I can't go to something than be afraid to apply. So I've done a lot of saying yes, even when I'm not sure what the outcome is going to be. This sometimes is detrimental when I don't always think about the timing. So I will admit I'm not the best on that. And I think my husband will be the first to tell you that sometimes my sense of time might not exist in three dimensions. But I would say that, I try to look at when I'm not at work and I'm not spending time with my family, what would I like to say I did for the year? And sometimes that helps me focus on, well, if I commit to giving a conference talk, like some people commit to, you know, running a 5K, when you do that, you schedule out time for yourself. You look at how you're going to accomplish what you're doing. And it's kind of that previous, like I look at a bigger task, I break it down to smaller chunks, and then I try to accomplish those and see where it's going to take me.
I love it. I love the sense I get of just kind of continuous growth, and I love that thought of just risk taking and putting yourself out there, and maybe not knowing what's going to come from it, but trying different things. I think that's such a great way to stay flexible and nimble, but also just always challenging yourself and growing. I really admire that.
Yeah, thanks. I think it's doesn't always work. Sometimes you have grand failures, nothing that's been too detrimental so far. But then it's just, for me, I think it's a way of kind of keeping interested in all the different aspects that I would like to be involved in.
And I'm realizing we're at the end of our time, but I want to, you know, leave the last 5 minutes. I always want to kind of make room because I appreciate all the questions you answered, and I think it was such a great detailed look at your role and your company and working remotely and work-life balance and all of these different topics. I'm sure that there's a lot that we didn't cover that you could share about, and I'm just kind of curious in these last 5 minutes, what have we not talked about that you'd like to leave listeners with or to share with the audience?
Sure. I think maybe two pieces. So I'm a parent and veteran in tech and a woman in tech. And I think that my experience so far, my first experience was not fantastic, to be honest. My experience now has been wonderful. And I would like to credit that with the leadership, you know, at Concur. And Elena Donio used to be our president. And I think she really helped, and Steve Singh and Mike Eberhard right now. But they all set a great precedent of what we should be looking at as a company and valuing. And I think that your company should do that. So if you are someone who has external commitments and has a life outside, you should really look for a company who senses that in you. And I think that I would leave with people of, you know, if you have mobility, don't put up with your life being miserable. Like there, especially if you're working at technology, there's probably other choices, other teams that are a better fit, a role that's a better fit, a company that's a better fit. So don't be afraid to look at what you want to be doing, how you want your life to be. And I know that's not an option for everybody. Some people have responsibilities or things that they can't change at the time, but I would say just keep that in mind. And especially for veterans, if you feel like you're in a place where you don't have options, please reach out to other veterans because we love to help each other. I don't think I've denied anybody's LinkedIn requests or offer to connect for HR purposes. Or I'm not a hiring manager once again, but I'm happy to try to recommend you to other people. I would say the second part is from being a parent, and I give this advice to every new parent. If you possibly can, every week, try to give you and your spouse each one night off where the other person can kind of do whatever they want, whether it's work or ski or hike or sleep. And then the other parent just is in charge of everything. Sometimes this means you might have to remove yourself from the house. You might have to maybe go somewhere else and then come back after the kids go to bed. But I think that that gives the other parent a chance to be in charge without, you know, somebody else's opinion. It also gives you, usually most people, if they've been in the military and they're getting out or at some point with your career, you just kind of maybe need a little bit of room to be yourself and be independent, like you probably were before you had kids. And I think it's a great opportunity to give that as a gift to the person that you're raising children with, and as well as for them to give that gift to you.
I love both of those pieces of advice. The one, you know, the last one that you just shared, though, is my wife and I think of having kids. You know, when you were saying that, I'm like, oh, that's great. And I'm thinking of the aspect of having a night off to go do something and keep yourself alive and doing things in your life. But I really, really like that thought that you had too of giving the other parent the room to parent in their own style and to not have the other person pointing out different ways to do it and just giving them that autonomy. That's such a, I imagine that's such a beautiful way to be able to connect with your kid and in a different way than when you're both there kind of catering to them and helping them out.
Yeah, and I think you find out very quickly that kids know the dynamics that exist when people are in the room, right? Sometimes they'll know the difference between it's just one or it's both. But you're absolutely right that it's really nice, especially even when they're tiny, to be honest, to be able to, if you're not the primary caretaker, to give the other person that opportunity to have that relationship with this new person. And with making decisions and figuring things out, you know, with nobody standing over your shoulder and telling you, well, that's not how you change a diaper. And then I think the other part of that is if you want to make pancakes, you get to make pancakes and nobody else is there to tell you that's not a good idea. And you just get to be the hero and it's wonderful. And it doesn't really matter if there's a syrup overload, but just, I think it's the most fun. You kind of get that. You guys get to have this different relationship with these small people that you're already excited about. You know, but maybe you just otherwise wouldn't get the opportunity to.
Well, Amanda, this is fantastic. I just appreciate your time and your perspective. And I think maybe there was this subconscious assumption before we connected that you hear data scientist and then you think that the person's going to be completely off in their own world or not articulated. I don't know if it's the conferences you've been doing or what, but you're just so eloquent in the descriptions you give and the way in which you take incredibly difficult conversation or topics and make them accessible to myself. And I imagine to people who are on active duty listening to this. So I just really appreciate your willingness to share your story with us.
Thank you so much for having me. And really, I have a real passion for trying to get more veterans into tech, especially more women veterans. So people that need help or assistance, I'm very available on Twitter, LinkedIn. I'm not as communicative on, but please feel free to connect and I'd love to help point you in different directions.
All right. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Amanda as much as I did. I wanted to stick around just a few minutes afterwards to give a quick debrief, some of the things that stood out with me. First of all, I just really, really admire this sense of saying yes, even when you don't know the outcome, and how Amanda is filling out these applications, taking risks, and it's so evident committed to her own personal and professional growth. And I love, you know, Gary Vaynerchuk talks about this as your side hustle, but I love how she's doing these conferences. She's writing books. She's active on social media. She's doing the NASA volunteering. How she is just, you know, treating that, like she said, like running a race. She's scheduling time to do these things. And I think that that's so incredible and worthy of admiration. I love this sense throughout our interview of just thinking of the future of technology. And it's inspiring to me to think of someone who's in a role where she really is trying to envision out 5 years of what technology will be like and how people are using it and how to build the tools and features that will make people's lives easier. I think that's worth looking at as a career, anything in that aspect. And then I really just what came through for me is Amanda's passion about her career, the level of fulfillment she feels, and how she may have gotten it wrong previously, but has really found a team and company and culture that's exactly what she's looking for. And I think that that's great, and I appreciated her advice about really not settling, that there are so many different options, both in terms of a company and team and roles, and just there are so many possibilities. And while many of us in our military service, we may have been restricted to staying there for a certain amount of time, and you know there's not a lot you can do about it, not true in the civilian sector. You can leave a job or a boss or anything if you don't like that. And I love that she articulated, you know, using that veteran connection and realizing how eager other veterans are to help you if you're not in a position that you enjoy. So those were the main things that stood out for me. Great interview. Just really appreciated her eloquence in speaking to these things and just felt like one of those interviews where I just wanted to get out of the way and give her as much airtime as possible because she was giving so much efficient information. So I hope you enjoyed this episode. I'll be back next week with more interviews with military veterans about their civilian career. Have a great week.